Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Les Leopold, author of the book The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, who talks about the fight ahead on re-regulating America's banking system. Malalai Joya, former member of the Afghanistan Parliament and author, who explains why she stands in opposition to the continued U.S. occupation of her nation, President Karzai, and his challenger, Abdullah Abdullah. And activist Larry Gibson, who describes the devastation mountaintop removal coal mining has wrought on his family's home at Cayford Mountain in West Virginia. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Higher oil prices and new drilling technology has renewed interest amongst big oil companies and their backers in exploiting Alaska's untapped offshore oil fields. Oil giant Shell sees the prospect of pumping 27 billion barrels of crude oil, similar to the oil bonanza at Prudhoe Bay, which has now become depleted. Environmentalists and other critics say new offshore oil leases between 3 and 200 miles offshore creates the prospect of another Exxon Valdez-style disaster. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the biggest prize for drilling rights is the Chukchi Sea, an ice-covered region between Alaska and Russia that is similar in size to the Gulf of Mexico. Currently, there are only 5 oil rigs in the Chukchi Sea, but Shell recently paid over $2 billion for oil leases there. Native groups see the new offshore drilling activity as a threat to their traditional culture, to whales and other marine mammals. Lawsuits filed by environmentalists also cast doubt on the legality of oil leases granted by the Bush administration. A federal appeals court labeled the leases granted in 2008 flawed and irrational. As the housing market started to crumble in late 2007, Moody's Investor Services, a top credit rating agency trusted by investors, pushed out executives who had sent up warning flags about the danger of mortgage-backed securities. The booming financial services company, on the eve of the financial crash, promoted key executives from its structured finance division who worked with Wall Street bankers to repackage mortgages and other securities to sell to investors. Moody's also padded its compliance department with people who gave the highest ratings to mortgage pools that later were downgraded to junk status. According to McClatchy newspapers, the full extent of the conflict of interest in the credit rating agencies, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch, is still poorly understood a year after the stock market crash. Former Moody's Vice President Mark Frober says the demise of the credit agency began in 2000 when management promoted a new aggressive business-friendly culture that made it difficult to assign critical ratings to securities. From 2001 to 2006, Moody's more than doubled its revenues, making big profits from packaging deals and giving high ratings to mortgage-backed securities. Now, more than 60% of the mortgages rated by Moody's have been downgraded. Congress is now debating a major overhaul of financial services regulation, including creating a new consumer watchdog agency. On Election Day, November the 3rd, the fight over same-sex marriage will be centered in Maine. Voters will decide the fate of Question 1, which could overturn a new law permitting gay marriage. In many ways, the campaign over Question 1 is a replay of Proposition 8 that banned gay marriage in California last year. Foes of gay marriage in Maine have hired the same media consultant to run their ads. The No on One campaign is being run by the former campaign manager of Governor John Balducci, a two-term Democrat, and has opened field offices in 5 cities. Backers of gay marriage are currently leading the fundraising race, even though the Catholic Diocese of Portland, Maine, is strongly supporting the ban on gay marriage. In the closing days of the campaign, anti-gay marriage forces received an infusion of over $1 million from the National Organization for Marriage, a group that the No on One campaign calls a radical anti-equality group from New Jersey. According to an analysis by the 538 website, over 80% of the anti-gay marriage funding came from 2 large donors, the National Organization for Marriage, and the Catholic Diocese of Portland, Maine. In contrast, gay marriage backers have developed a base of small donors from Maine and nationally, along with the support of several big donors, including the Human Rights Campaign. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
With the national debate on health care reform set for a likely congressional vote before the end of the year, the issue of establishing new banking regulations is now coming into focus. 1 year after the financial meltdown that ushered in the worst U.S. economic downturn since the Great Depression, the Obama administration and Congress have set their sights on passing laws to rein in the risky behavior of financial institutions that were deemed too big to fail during the 2008 financial collapse. Obama, reacting to public anger, has recently imposed caps on executive salaries and bonuses in banks receiving billions of dollars in government bailout funds. Legislation being proposed would force the nation's largest banks and investment firms to hold more funds in reserve and make it more difficult to engage in casino-like behavior with other people's money. But some observers say the administration's proposed new regulations don't go far enough, and instead favor breaking up the big banks, making it less likely that taxpayers would in the future be called to pay for another trillion-dollar bailout. But the nation's financial institutions blamed for bringing down the economy are now gearing up to use their enormous wealth to fight new regulations. The loss of jobs, homes, and savings has motivated an estimated 5,000 activists, many of them union members, to protest in the streets of Chicago during the recent annual convention of the American Bankers Association. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Les Leopold, author of the new book, The Looting of America: How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It, who talks about the fight ahead on re-regulating America's banks.
What I'm about to say now is virtually outside the pale of the debate, but I actually think that it's the only thing that's going to prevent us from heading into what I call the billionaire bailout society. I don't think we're living under capitalism anymore. We're living in a new kind of world where money is still accumulating in the hands of the few, and it's the system is now set up with institutions that are too big to fail, such that we bail them out when they get into trouble. We transferred more money a year ago from the taxpayer to Wall Street. We transferred more wealth than at any time since slavery. It was an enormous amount of money. The estimate isn't just TARP money. All the other guarantees we put into place come to about $13 trillion. So here's what we basically have to do is undo the experiment. I hate to say it, but I am a Teddy Roosevelt and Dwight D. Eisenhower Republican. That's how radical we have to be. We have to go back to Teddy Roosevelt and Dwight D. Eisenhower. It's not Glass-Steagall is not enough. We have to actually, even if we broke institutions into two large institutions that had the Glass-Steagall wall between them, that's not good enough. They have to be small enough to fail. They can't be so large that when they get into trouble, it forces us to bail them out. They have to be small enough to actually fail. We have to go back to the trust-busting days of Teddy Roosevelt, who was riding on the crest of the populist progressive movement at the time. And people understood that concentration of that kind of power had to be broken up. The other thing we need to do is we have to dramatically change the tax system. Right now, and this is something that George Soros said, the entire Wall Street has been given a gift, he put it. I call it they're on welfare. When we put, in this country, when we put low-income people on welfare, we put very tough conditions on people getting that money. They've got to work, they can't get too much income, et cetera, et cetera. We've got nothing going on Wall Street except for the major troubled, quote-unquote, institutions. But the ones that have paid back TARP but are still taking advantage of all these other welfare subsidies we're giving, they're free to do what they want. That can't be. We need what I called for. It's interesting. I called for it in The Looting of America, and now it's even more relevant. we need what I call the president's wage cap. Nobody on Wall Street earns more than the president of the United States until unemployment comes down below 5%. Because what we haven't talked about is this tragedy is not just a transfer of money. There are 29 million people right now who don't have jobs or working part-time, but they want to work full-time. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has a U6 unemployment rate. It stands at 17% right now. That's a tragedy. And we have to tie the fate of Wall Street to the fate of the real economy. And one good way to do it is to slap an across-the-board wage cap. The other thing we need to do is have a windfall profits tax. I mean, it's outrageous that Goldman Sachs is going to have a record profit year. How did they do that, I wonder? Well, if you give them, you know, billions of dollars, they're going to make money.
A lot of these big financial institutions that were bailed out to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars by the U.S. taxpayers are now fighting tooth and nail against any kind of substantive re-regulation of the finance industry to prevent another collapse in the future. What are we up against as a country here in trying to fight our way back to the regulations that were put in place after the Great Depression and that ushered in a real era of prosperity for this country?
Look, we have to fight back. We need to build a movement. All the pressure on the Obama administration and Congress is coming from the banking community. Very little is coming from the progressive side. It's like I think a lot of people feel so intimidated about finance that they just don't want to get involved. And that's why I wrote this book. Then we've got to get mobilized. Like what's happening in Chicago right now with, you know, some demonstrations at the American Bankers Association. We need a lot more of that because the sentiment is there. You can talk to anybody in the country about these issues virtually, and people will agree with you, but we need to get them mobilized. You know, it took a generation for the populace to get their act together and actually change the world. It took a generation before the New Deal. All those ideas came from the labor movement and from progressive movements in the 20s and before. They finally came into fruition in the 1930s. It's going to take real organizing on our part to change the world. It's not going to just happen with Twitter and Facebook. We're going to have to go out there and build institutions and build a movement that's going to fight back against the bankers.
That was Les Leopold, author of the book The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. Visit his website at thelootingofamerica.org. As President Obama considered the adoption of a new strategy in Afghanistan, which could include the deployment of 40,000 or more additional U.S. troops, October has become the deadliest month for Americans in the eight-year war. Eight American soldiers died in two bomb blasts on October 27th, preceded by the deaths of 11 U.S. troops and three drug enforcement agents in two separate helicopter crashes. The Obama administration has delayed making a decision about sending additional forces to Afghanistan, partly based on the political uncertainty tied to the results of the August 20th Afghan presidential election. Widespread evidence of vote rigging and fraud has forced incumbent President Hamid Karzai into a November 7th runoff election with his second-place challenger, former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Malalai Joya, a critic of the U.S., NATO, and Afghanistan's powerful warlords, who became the youngest person elected in Afghanistan's new parliament in 2005. 2 years later, she was suspended from the legislative body for her persistent criticism of the warlords and drug barons. A survivor of four assassination attempts, she has written a new book titled A Woman Among Warlords, The Extraordinary Story of an Afghan Who Dared to Raise Her Voice. Here, Malalai explains why she stands in opposition to the continued U.S. occupation of her nation, President Karzai, and his challenger, Abdullah Abdullah.
Karzai, the shameless puppet man who again running for the presidential election, and Abdullah Abdullah, who was minister of this mafia corrupt system of Hamid Karzai. And either of them, when it will be like the same donkey with different saddle. As my people before of the result of the election, they discussed people on the streets among each other that only one puppet can be replaced with another one. And they have many similarity. Both of them betrayed a lot my people in the past. And as right now, for example, Hamid Karzai chose the two cruel men like Qasim Fahim and Karim Khalili as vice president. Both of them accused as war criminals. And even Human Rights Watch said that he insults the people of Afghanistan. But I'm saying, no, he's betraying my people because he do more compromise. And both of them, Dr. Abdullah and Karzai, they call Taliban these terrorist brothers and invite them to join the government. And also Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, this fascist man as well. And these terrorists also come in power. The situation will be more bloody and disaster for people of my country, especially women of my country. And also that millions of dollars they spend, just they waste the money, while most of my people, all of my people know them very well. As this 8 years, they changed Afghanistan to the center of drug and also to the safe haven for terrorism.
Malalai, I want to ask you, in your view, what has the U.S. and NATO military presence in your country, Afghanistan, what has been the effect? We're told here in the United States that the overthrow of the Taliban government has been a good thing for the majority of the Afghan people.
Under the banner of women rights, human rights, democracy, 8 years ago, U.S. and its allies occupied my country. In the meantime, they pushed us from the frying pan to the fire because they replaced Taliban with the North Alliance fundamentalist terrorists, who are brother in creed of the Taliban from 92 to 96. They did civil war in Afghanistan. And same crimes like Taliban they committed against women rights, human rights. And more troops will bring more conflict, more war. I think Democrat people of U.S. agree with us, and it's justice-loving people around the world, that democracy never come by barrel of gun. Democracy never come by war. To know better about the role of these occupation forces in Afghanistan, few example I'm giving to Democrat people of U.S. That they did bombing on May in Farah province in the west of Afghanistan. 150 civilians has been killed, most of them women and children. Even they used white phosphorus and cluster bomb. On 9th of September, recently, they did bombing Kunduz province. 200 civilians has been killed. Again, most of them women and children. Even they are bombing our wedding parties. After all of these war crimes, White House says, apologize, and Karzai's puppet, this mafia corrupt system, says thank you. No, my people don't want to listen anymore. Thank you, and also apologize. They want the end of this so-called war on terror, which is war on innocent civilians. As long as these troops to be in Afghanistan, the worst civil war will be, because their government, means U.S. government and NATO, these 40 countries who are in Afghanistan, they are giving more money, more power to such a terrorist people like warlords and now negotiating with Taliban. So as long as these warlords they will be in power as now negotiating with Taliban, there is no hope to come positive changes in Afghanistan. This election was just a showcase. Election under the shadow of gun, warlordism, drug lordism, awful corruption, and occupation forces has no legitimacy at all. As a famous thing, it's not important who's voting, it's important who's counting. We have mafia system in Afghanistan.
Well, just the last question here for you, Malalai, and that is, if the U.S. troops were to withdraw from Afghanistan, what do you think would happen there? And that's certainly the question posed by a lot of people who are now opposed to an increase or an escalation of U.S. military presence in Afghanistan.
This 8 years, less than 2,000 Talib has been killed, more than 8,000 innocent civilians. That's why we say that they are not honest for my people. We are between two enemies. We are fighting occupation. We are fighting these warlords and Taliban, both of them puppet and killer and misogynist, first of all, against women rights. So one enemy get less, these occupation forces, then it's much easier to fight against one enemy instead of two. But my message, on behalf of suffer voiceless people of my country, on behalf of Democrat people of my country, to great Democrat American people is that, please raise your voice against the strong policy of your government, against this war crime. Please support morally and financially, educationally, support my people, support Democrat parties, support Democrat intellectuals in Afghanistan. They are able to fight terrorism and also fundamentalism. But now, the policy of Obama, foreign policy of Obama, unfortunately quite similar like the wrong policy of Bush.
That was Malalai Joya, former member of the Afghanistan Parliament and author of the new book, A Woman Among Warlords, the extraordinary story of an Afghan who dared to raise her voice. Visit her website at MalalaiJoya.com. Coal-fired power plants produce almost half the energy used in the U.S. and create almost 40% of global warming carbon emissions, as well as many other toxic pollutants, including mercury. It's also a dirty deal at the production end, especially the relatively new method of coal extraction known as mountaintop removal mining. That's where coal companies, using tons of explosives, blast the tops off Appalachian mountain ridges to get at the thin seams of coal underneath. They drop the resulting rocks and clay into the valleys below, burying streams and brooks. So far, the process has destroyed more than 800 square miles of land and buried more than 1,000 miles of waterways. Coal companies also inject toxic coal slurry into the mountains, where it poses a risk of spilling into the countryside below, threatening homes and schools. Larry Gibson lived with his extended family on the top of Caford Mountain in southern West Virginia for generations, until land companies swindled his relatives out of their property and leased it to Massey Energy. The company blasted the top off the mountain and created a huge moonscape where a diverse ecosystem used to exist. Gibson is held onto a tiny piece of land where he hosts both locals and visitors who want to see what mountaintop removal has done to the land. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus visited Gibson on Caford Mountain and recorded a talk he gave to 100 college students on October 17th, who were there as part of Mountain Justice Fall Summit. What follows is a short excerpt.
And then people say, well, you know, it's hard to see that you have an unbiased opinion of the industry because you got an attitude. Yeah. Yeah, I just don't see where they figure that. Yes. You know, people, I have an attitude, yes. And some people think, when they listen to hear I'm talking, they think I'm 9 foot tall, yes. You know, it's not the structure of a man that makes a man dangerous. It's the words of a man. I tell you why I fight so hard for this land. You know, I come from this dirt here. As a child, you know, a young boy, I've told stories about how it was for me playing with the earth and the land. You don't have to answer me today. You don't even have to answer yourself today. But I'm going to ask you now, like I've asked Nikki here and Andrew when they came here, and everybody who knows me, I asked this question to over 14,000 people. Now, what do you have so close to your own circle of life? What do you have to your own circle of life that you don't have a price on it? What would it be for you? How far would you go to stand for it if someone comes to destroy it? And what would you do? You've heard me mention a while ago about having 136 acts of violence and shootings and vandalism and just out and out meanness here. You know, I told my people, long time ago, I got to tell you too, I'm against coal. I'm not saying, I'm not against coal, I'm just against mountaintop removal. No, people, no. Coal kills. That's a definite answer. Coal kills. When you call for the elimination of mountaintop removal and not the abomination of coal, you're just okaying it. You're going to be an enabler for them to continue to do it. And some people say, we need a transitional period, they say. You know, a time to change over. Well, hell, we've had 135 years. We can't afford another 135 years. I'll settle for 10, maybe. And then that's too damn long. Not when we got... When we got the means to do it tomorrow, the switch on the wall. Now, ask yourself again, what do you have so close to your own circle of life that you don't have a price on it, and they come to destroy it. What would you do to stand for it? How far would you go? People, I didn't back up as far as I'm backing up. I ain't backing up. I ain't never took a back step. Reporters asked me a lot of times, have you ever considered losing? No. That's not even in my vocabulary. Don't even know what it means. Because if I had considered losing, I'd have never started in the first place. I got so much to talk to you about. I'm bouncing back and forth, trying to give you some stuff here. And I'm trying to tell you about how much the land is supposed to be worth now. The land is supposed to be worth $650 million. If you came here and seen the rich guy who owned all his wealth, Donald Trump would be calling me sir. You're saying, but don't you know, I am the richest person you've ever seen. Because you see, I do live with the land, and I like life that lives on the land with me. I share this place with the wild game and the people. And you know, when I catch a snake, a copperhead or a rattlesnake, most people would kill them right away. I move them. If they come back knocking at my door, I'll kill them. But I give them a chance. These people here don't give anyone a chance. You know, mountaintop removal, when it's done, remember what I was talking about, dead, dead. Dead sounds definite. It's definite. Dead. It's definite. We have a little over 3.5 million acres in Appalachia destroyed. Less than 5%, not more than 5%, but not less than 2% that they've ever done anything with. It costs $3 million per acre to reclaim. When they get done, and to find a way to external the cost out, you're going to be paying for it, every one of you. And that's why I tell you now, you come to see me. If you think I'm mad, you people should be viciously mad because you're going to pay for it. Your great-grandchildren will pay for what they're doing today. So, you know, it's like me. I tell people the sand in my eyeglass is almost gone. The sand in your eyeglass hadn't even started moving yet. Y'all got a chance to stop the madness.
That was anti-coal activist Larry Gibson. Contact him at area code 304-542-1134 or visit his website at mountainkeeper.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.